number five. Thank you both for your help. The United States versus Christopher J. Bitterman. Determine.
My name is Renee Hernandez. I represent the defendant, Christopher J. Bitterman, the defendant appellant in this case. This case involves a bank robbery trial that went to trial approximately December 17th, if I remember correctly, of last year. It was a three-day trial in which the United States presented Michael Anderson, a convicted felon for the crime, who had a plea agreement with the United States to give his testimony so that Mr. Bitterman may be convicted. In return, he received credit and time off of his sentence, significant time off of his sentence. This case, without Michael Anderson, could not, in any case, survive a directed verdict without Mr. Anderson, and without Mr. Anderson before a jury could not have gone anywhere. The U.S.'s case hinged upon Anderson's testimony, hinged upon his credibility, and one of the propositions that I set forth today and in my brief and throughout the course of this litigation, in fact my post-trial motions, was to go to the issue of the credibility of Michael Anderson. Michael Anderson is a known convict, and in this case he had every incentive to lie. We believe he perjured himself not only once but multiple times during the course of this trial. He also presented inconsistent statements to the United States and its representatives and the proper.
But the court didn't find that to be true, did it? The jury found to be credible.
The jury ultimately found him credible. One of the issues that I raise is that the credibility of a witness, and in this particular case, Michael Anderson, is the one that we should be granted an opportunity as the defendant who's defending ourselves, our very lives, in this particular context, our freedom, of course, in this context, is that we should be given the opportunity to attack these inconsistent statements, these lies by Mr. Anderson. And specifically, we tried to introduce a witness, a Dominic Panatello, and during the course of our case, which we presented him, to bring in that very information. And the information from Mr. Anderson was that my client had a 9mm weapon, pistol, that very day.
But it wasn't involved in the crime, was it?
According to these individuals, that's what they're presenting. But the whole proposition is that he's lying there, he's lying about the other gun. And when you take the lies all together...
Now I'm a little confused. It's pretty vital for a district court to be able to control how much collateral evidence comes in. Could you try to introduce evidence to show that he lied to his mother about whether he had chocolate milk at lunch at school one day?
Of course not. We're talking about relevancy.
So we're just talking about whether something is collateral to the case or not. And here the district judge said this 9mm gun has nothing to do with this case. It's agreed that the gun used in the robbery was a BB gun.
Well, if you want to limit the agreement, but there's something more to this, because I think there's a plan, there's an organization of thought, there's this conspiracy going on, and I think under the federal rules of evidence, I think that this particular concept issued to the United States and its government agents is certainly relevant. And one point, here's his story, and then in the trial it becomes something else.
How do you compare a BB gun to a 9mm gun?
Only in the context of what it shoots out of it, Judge, but the bottom line is they're both guns. They were both perceived.
Sure.
Obviously, they'd both be perceived. And, in fact, the judge made the finding it was a dangerous weapon.
He has to make that.
Of course. And we don't disagree with that. Obviously, we objected to it, but you know, for our record purposes. But in this context, when you see about the planning, it becomes a relevant context. Where the chocolate milk would have no relevant context, here we're talking about the planning. If you're going to say Michael Anderson and Chris Bitterman had this great conspiracy and plan to commit this crime, I think that you talk about all of the planning and all of the information and the statements that were given by this individual, Michael Anderson, which the United States could not have gotten past directed verdict without him. So we should be given that opportunity to attack him with all vigor, that we should be allowed this particular opportunity, especially when he puts it in the context of his proffer to the United States. And I think conversely, had I have used Mr. Anderson, if we could change the fact pattern a little, in terms of if the United States had information that he had lied to them, believe me, that the United States would have jumped all over that, and they would have been demanding the right to bring that in to attack and destroy his credibility, as I attempted to do. It should be noted, and throughout the course of Mr. Anderson's testimony, his self-serving testimony, he talked about a series of things that are going on during the course of his portion of it. He talks about his own testimony contradicts himself. He says, well, we just got heroin the night before, and then when they go for this bank robbery, just several hours later, my client's going through heroin withdrawals and vomiting, so therefore he doesn't go into the bank. Well, you know, the distinguishing is that, you know, it doesn't work that way, and the government's own witnesses testify as to what it takes for heroin withdrawal to kick in. It doesn't kick in like that. It kicks in over time when there's a longer period of time, not just a few hours in the time span. Moreover, there was money to buy some drugs. Was it enough to sufficiently help their habit? Who knows? But both of these guys had money, and the money came from Anderson, who testified that we had money. We talked about and we raised the issue of the 404B evidence, which was raised by the United States. The United States uses this evidence to demonstrate the motive. We believe and we concede properly that the United States had every right to introduce the initial evidence to demonstrate that my client was an addict at the time and in temporal relationship to the crime. We believe that that's relevant. And that evidence was sufficient, and I, you know, conceded that at the district court level, and I don't have a problem with it here today. The problem becomes is that the United States then continually, repeatedly kept bringing in the heroin addiction. It's almost as if their case in chief almost took the collateral road here, and let's go A and B, and let's use this a lot, because this, you know, anything we can get to pound this particular defendant, we're going to use it. And I think that's exactly what happened, because then it becomes an issue of destroying his character. It's clear this gentleman didn't have a lot of things going on, of course. He made very poor decisions, very irresponsible at this particular point.
Well, didn't it conversely, didn't it also destroy Anderson, but because he was also using the heroin, and the jury saw fit to believe Anderson?
Well, I think Anderson got a much better pass than my client.
We're talking about a pass. We're talking about the history of them both using cocaine.
Well, it was heroin and cocaine.
I believe that's your argument.
Yes, my argument is that my guy got the beating by the United States. They did not place their emphasis on Michael Anderson.
But they were both using it at the same time. That's what was argued. Isn't that true?
I believe there's the relationship, not always right together, but yes, I believe there was usage throughout the time
right
period.
Right up to the date of the crime.
Yes. But I think going through the first
on.
Year... I'm sorry.
From high school on.
And I think that is one of the problems when you go right to the first year of high school and continue on for several more years.
Would the junior year have been better?
Certainly would have been closer in time. I mean, it's a point. If you say, well, 1 year versus 4 years, I think the impression you make to a series of 12 relative strangers.
But both of them
were
stupid,
important.
Is what I'm trying to point out to you. If it applied to one, it applied to the other.
Well, Mr. Anderson had a very sweet deal, whereas my client didn't.
Well, that's not what we're talking about.
True. But I'm talking about the
jury didn't
evidence.
Believe it. Didn't believe your argument.
Well, certainly. And I think that when you have multiple instances where you have the information pounded and pounded in, it certainly does have a prejudicial effect on the 12 individuals who represent the society and make the judgment here. In addition, in my brief, I also bring up the component as to the jury instruction, which was raised here. The jury instruction presented to the jury and originally presented and agreed to by the parties accurately did reflect this court's representations of the Seventh Circuit pattern jury instructions. And I would like to reserve a little time for my rebuttal so that I can address that before I, Ms. Sharon, I'll let the United
States.
Pretty
close, right? All right.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, my name is John McKenzie. I'm representing the United States along with Barry Eldon of our office. Your Honor, as to the 9mm gun, the Court's correct. It had nothing to do with the case. There was testimony on cross-examination of Michael Anderson, and that's the first time it was brought out. On cross-examination, that at a previous point in time, he had proffered to the government, to the FBI in the United States, that the morning of the robbery, Mr. Bitterman was playing with or handling a 9mm gun. That's as far as it goes. The gun wasn't used in the robbery. There was never an intent to use the gun in the robbery. The plan was to use the BB gun in the robbery, and the record's very clear on that. So it was a collateral issue, as the court noted, because the district court should have the ability to police its own courtroom to make sure that collateral evidence, irrelevant evidence, doesn't get in front of the jury. The district court properly did so. Your Honor, on the heroin addiction, defense counsel acknowledges heroin addiction, in the context especially of a bank robbery, is motive evidence and is admissible. And the court's correct when it notes about the continuum of it. The evidence was that these two individuals had been friends from junior high, especially in high school when they began using heroin together. They continued its heroin together, and the heroin evidence set out both the relationship as well as showed his both defendants continuing fall into this heroin addiction and continuing increased motive to commit the armed bank robbery. Defense counsel did not object to the evidence at trial. He didn't say at that point, Judge, we don't want you to go into this back in the freshman year of high school. It's only upon appeal that he brings this out. So he's now related to where he only has the plain error standard. He cannot show that there was error in admitting this evidence, and he can't show that he was prejudiced from the admission of this evidence. Judge, as far as the jury instructions, if the court will look at the jury instructions, all it is, the supplemental instruction is a combination of two instructions that were given to the jury. It's a combination of the instruction 2.01, which says the defendant is charged with this, and 5.06, which is the accessory instruction. It's a slight rewording of the accessory instruction. It kind of switches the clauses. But other than that, it's the exact instruction that was given. There was no objection to it given, and the defendant has not alleged or even shown or tried to show how this was error, much less prejudice his client. We ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
One of the issues that need to be acknowledged is that a jury instruction has great weight before a jury and when they're deliberating. In terms of a trial, we look at the jury instructions you're given, and each one taken in context. If you add them and you supplement them, it gives an undue weight to that particular instruction. Taken as a whole, the instructions were proper, they were given correctly, but then when you add them together and redo them again, it gives the government an undue advantage. I did object. That's a misstatement. I did object. I objected to any miscorrection of it or any modification of the jury instruction. And so I did tell Judge Reinhardt that, and I continued my objection, and then I suggested another alternative, which is my burden. I said, this is what maybe we could live with, but that's not what happened, obviously. I'm paraphrasing. But and then, obviously, the jury or the judge submitted it the way he did. So taken as a whole, it does have an effect.
If you need an extra minute, go ahead.
It does have an effect, Judge, and that is the point, because you give it extra weight when the jury's back there and they're deliberating. They see it. They see their note answered, and their answer says, this is what it is, versus saying, you have your jury instructions. You have them. They are correct. They are from this circuit. That is what this court has told us. This is what's proper to use, and it puts an undue influence on the particular jury instruction. They didn't indict them that way. That's not what the indictment read. So this is what they're stuck with. If you wanted them that way, they should have indicted them that way. That should have been what should have been read in the actual indictment so that they could read to the jury specifically. They didn't do it that way. So they're stuck with what they got. So it left the jury with the undue prejudicial effect to my client. So with that in mind, we're asking this court to reverse the judgment of the jury and order a new trial.
Were you court appointed?
Yes, I was.
You did a very good job. Thank you very much on behalf of the court.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, too, counsel.